I'm really excited and slightly anxious to announce that my book, The Autistic Burnout Workbook, is releasing this next week. It comes out March 11th. It's available for pre-order right now. I am trying to avoid falling back into burnout. When you release a book, there is a lot of pressure to do promotion and to market and to get the word out there. So this is my burnout prevention form of marketing. I'm running a special right now for those who are supporting my work through pre-ordering. You can submit that information after you pre-order, and we will get you a coupon code that you can use toward our store for the same amount. So the workbook costs $18.99. So then you'd get $18.99 to use in our digital shop or in our Etsy shop, which would get you another digital workbook for free. So you buy one workbook and then you get a digital one for free. That is the promotion I'm running. It's technically a pre-order promotion, but I've been a bit behind on getting the word out. So for listeners of the podcast, I'm going to extend that. If you buy the book in the next month, you can go ahead and redeem the special. The link for that is in the notes below. Thank you so much for supporting my work. It means so much to me, and I just really appreciate you and hope that you will find this a helpful resource for you as you continue to build a life that is a bit more resilient to autistic burnout.
Hey, everyone. You are listening to the Divergent Conversations podcast. We are two neurodivergent mental health professionals in a neurotypical world. I'm Patrick Cassell.
And I'm Dr. Neff.
And during these episodes, we do talk about sensitive subjects, mental health, and there are some conversations that can certainly feel a bit overwhelming. So we do just want to use that disclosure and disclaimer before jumping in. And thanks for listening.
Okay, well, before we started hitting, oh my goodness, words are going to be a struggle for me today. I can already tell, just putting that out there to the universe. Before we hit record, I was telling Sandra and Patrick that I'm over here like kind of a giddy version of myself, because this is the first time I get to meet Sandra. We've messaged on Instagram and email, and every time we've had an interaction, I walk away kind of with a deep sigh, feeling more embodied, feeling like there's ideas I'm kind of marinating on. You just have a way of being in the world that I think takes people deeper into their experience and brings in and ushers in conversations of complexity in a way that doesn't automatically invoke psychological defenses. And I don't come across a lot of thinkers like that. And so I've admired your work for the last couple of years. I first knew you as ND Narratives on Instagram. I've since followed your work other places. Like, I love your Substack, and I think you do kind of deeper writing there, and you've just published a book. It's never just ADHD, finding the child behind the label, or it's in the process of being published. It'll probably be published soon after we release this. Yay. Okay. So in my like fangirl excitement, what did I miss about who you are? How would you like to introduce yourself to our audience?
Oh my goodness. Well, first off, thank you so much. I don't think I've ever had such a welcome before, and just, really a lot of gratitude, and just, I have so much respect for your work. Oh my goodness. You're actually quoted in my book.
Yeah. Oh, just no way.
Definitely. I love, and we'll get all into that. I should have time for your question, actually. What's it? My name is Sandra. I am the new author. But writer, content creator, podcaster behind Neurodivergent Narratives, and that's ND Narratives, dot narratives, not ID in my platforms. But I'm queer, Black person who has few neurodivergence, autistic, ADHD, OCD, goes on like that. I write a lot about the intersection of race, gender, neurodivergence, and somatic work, trauma, and I write a lot about disconnection and trying to I don't like an us versus them sort of thing, you know, like I try to write in a way that helps us all see like our own humanity and the humanity in each other as well. So that's,
I think that's what strikes me about your work is like you embody and you do what you advocate for, right? So like you talk a lot about disconnection and moving toward integration, and you do that in the way you communicate. And I don't, yeah, that's what I find so just kind of so distinctive about your work. And so I would say grounding. It feels really like grounded advocacy, like it's integrative.
Oh, wow.
I don't know how you are with compliments. I'm really hard with compliments, so I'll like ease off the gas pedal here.
I'm like this, like my hands are like, you know.
I'm so sorry. I'm like, welcomed you onto my podcast and just, you know.
No, I appreciate it.
Blooded you with compliments, so I'll, yeah. We forgot to mention that you're a somatic coach. So that's part of it. And I think that's part of the groundedness of what you bring is you do often bring it back to this aspect of embodiment.
Yeah, I like to. I do love narrative therapy as well, like because I think that I just inherently think that therapy is quite, violent. Like it's very subscriptive and we really need to, like take the problems out of the people, like, and put, you know, because when we can do that, we can start to see like other solutions. Like if the problem is inside you, then like basically the only thing you can do is blame everyone else or destroy yourself. Like, so yeah, that's why I love about narrative therapy too. So I try to bring that a lot into what I do as well. Because I think for a lot of neurodivergent, like people who have neurodivergence, I'm trying to figure out like what else to say with that, by the way, because like, and I do like my things is neurodivergent narratives, but like, I'm like, kind of feels like an us and them sort of separate thing. And I'm really about connection. I'm just kind of like, is that like neurodiversity, you know, which is like a whole, like, you know what I mean, how that is. But anyways, the whole thought about people do have solutions or ideas like inside them, like, and they have different stories that they've been told or have grown up like learning, believing about themselves. And they might not be true to how they actually saw the incidences and stuff for themselves. So when we can pull some of those out, and then they connect so somatically with those other stories, the ones that are more empowering, the ones that are more aligned with their truth, then then other solutions become apparent, if that makes sense.
It does. And it makes me curious. I love the subheading of your book, The Child Behind the Label. Is that kind of what you're getting at in the book, is that the narratives behind, well, I won't make assumptions. I'll just ask, but, because I loved that subtitle of like, getting behind the label.
Yeah.
Is that part of it, of getting to the more embodied narratives?
Well, finding the child behind the label is, what I was hoping for, like, because the story, like the book is split up into like 9 chapters plus introduction. And each chapter is a story about a different child in school with me as their teacher. And through that, you know, the one thing they all have in common is that they all have ADHD, even though it looks, you know, quite different. And what I'm trying to say in the book is that, like, you know, depending on, you know, the intersecting identities, like the social markers of child, depending on the social markers of the teacher, how we interpret the presentations of ADHD, you know, are different. And because of that, that impacts the kind of support that they're going to receive in school or whether they receive support or not. And like, it seems really like straightforward and very, you know, like that just seems like common sense to me, because of the way that the society is, but I guess it's not like it wasn't. Yeah, I guess it's not. So each chapter looks at, like I said, like a different child with each different identities, and just how they're interpreted and what kinds of things are barriers to their learning And how we can reduce some of those barriers. And it really does come down to a lot of somatic work too, like for the teacher, because, you know, I think a lot of neurodivergence is like, you know, rooted in a lot of disconnection and a lot of dysregulation, you know? So that's necessary to be able to meet kids' needs. And, you know, a dysregulated body is one that feels unsafe. Like that's inherently, that's what it is. So if you're seeing behaviors, quote, quote, or presentations that aren't aligned with what you think should be in a classroom and what you learned was in a classroom and what you learned about what teachers should be and what students should be, you're going to treat these children differently. You're going to see those presentations differently. You're going to act accordingly. And a lot of the times, if you're looking at, say, a Black kid, white teacher, like that's being very like surface level, that you're, how regulated are you going to be whenever you see their presentations? Mm-hmm. Are you going to interpret them as ADHD or not?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so that's what it is. And it's like, if you can look beyond like the label of ADHD, because we all have a definition of what it is. And if we have that definition, if we're staying with that definition, well, then we can't see like that child. And if we can't really see and find that child, then how can we connect with them? And to do that, we've got to look at what we're bringing into our classrooms as well, in schools or wherever as well.
So that's so true. And I'm just thinking while you're talking about how like the teacher's perception or understanding of what's going on and how they define and label it can have major implications in terms of that child's development, their educational trajectory and track, the support that they receive or do not receive, and the way that they are looked at. And that's such a fascinating take on it from that perspective, to break it down into those 9 different presentations and then offer support for the educator as well.
Yeah. I think it's why it took me like a while to write. I think it's really important to like note that like all kids, every one of us is impacted by like the culture, like the patriarchal white supremacy culture. Like we are all impacted in it. So even in this book, like it's not just, you know, even though I look at with race, gender, socioeconomic class and whatnot, I also include talking a little bit about whiteness and how white boys were impacted, you know, how white, you know, I mean, boys, girls, and, you know, specifically on purpose in that chapter because of the gender binary and how that actually adds another layer of harm within the culture and who gets missed even and what it means for even white children. Like this culture harms their own, you know, whiteness harms their own children. It's not necessarily, you know, we talk about it as being like a privilege to get a diagnosis. And yeah, and you know, in some ways, you know, it is depending on who you are and what that means. There's a reason why, Black communities weren't going to get their kids diagnosed for anything. It's like, do I need another label? Do I need another label? Is that going to benefit my kid? So it is like we have to see it through. Like, that's like our brains, you know, like they do label everything. And we have a culture that does label everything. And we have to go beyond those, including the label of ADHD, because, you know, for Black kids, it doesn't look like ADHD then. It depending on who is looking. And that it does, like Patrick said, has consequences and has had consequences. So, yeah. Thanks.
Yeah. I love that idea of getting beyond the label and even the ADHD label. Because you're right, the ADHD label itself still, like, especially in an education setting, it still influences how a teacher sees ADHD. We've had that conversation. Me and my spouse have had that conversation of do we want this medically validated in our child? Do we want the education system to know, kind of know, my spouse is in the education system. So mm-hmm. knowing what happens when a teacher sees that label. Then it gets so complex too, because it's the, I don't want another label. And then the other piece I often think about is when the ADHD label gets missed, what label gets put in its place? So either like we know for Black children, particularly in the US, conduct disorders, ODD, oppositional mm-hmm. defiant disorders, conduct disorders. So those are, an ADHD Black child's more likely to get those diagnoses than a white child. But also the internalized labels, right? Mm-hmm. I'm lazy, I'm incompetent, I'm too much. And so, yeah, this conversation of labels, both internal and external, is just really interesting to me. And I think I'm one of those people that kind of defaults to the ADHD or the autism label saves the day. But it doesn't. It's helpful, I think, to have an accurate narrative. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it also creates other problems in the society we live in.
Yeah, you know, like, that's the thing. It's like, because oftentimes, like, parents would ask me, like, do I disclose this or not? And it's like, well, kid's going to get a label anyways. And like, how do you want that label defined for your kids? Like, that's where advocacy comes in a lot, because we do need to be able to like help, you know, have our kids be able to be who they're going to be, you know, and what that means. Like, but then on the other side of this too, it's like, when we're looking at a label, like any of the neurodivergence, you know, any neurodivergence that, It has different consequences depending on what someone looks like and who's looking at them, and how they've defined it. And so, like, even things like, you know, in the book I've written something about, you know, ADHD is a superpower, or ADHD is a gift, which is a lot of things that, you know, ADHD is like the strength lists of, like, or more creative. We do this, we do that, you know, whatever they are. I don't even have a list of them, sort of thing, to try to, like, I don't know, like, to combat that. But when you look at it through the lens of like white supremacy culture, which, you know, then we got to ask ourselves, like, why do we got to be a superpower? Why does being different only become acceptable when it's beyond human? Like, mm-hmm. what are we saying about, like, difference in this society? And particularly, this isn't like a... Like, you know, I do know that Black and brown people's, you know, people might like pick up that, hey, she's a superpower label. But where do you think that stuff started? Like, I'm going to put a guess on where it started. And I'm going to say why. It's like, how can you, and this, I think, is a thing with whiteness as well. It's like, you know, when you're different, you know, when you're farther from the center of privilege, you need to find a way to belong or fit in. And if you already expect it to be perfect, because perfectionism is a, you know, a trait of white supremacy, then, you know, what are you going to do when you're different and you're being excluded? Okay, well, I got to be better than perfect. I got to be beyond perfect. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what better? I have a superpower. So, okay, so we're going to go in dehumanize our kids and each other. that's the further dehumanize. We're already dehumanized because of the pressures in each of us in different ways to be perfect, where you have, like, you know, white men, like, you know, the highest, you know, rates of suicide over the age of 50. Guess anyone? White cis males, men. Like, can we all sit with why that would be? Like, you know, that's like, everyone is dehumanized under this culture. And then you put a label, like, you know, any neurodivergence that's, you know, in blaring lights, like, I'm different. Mm-hmm. If you haven't, like, seen it already, you know, and, like, how do we fit? How do we find a way to fit by, like, oh, let's make it better than that. Let's look at strengths and stuff like this and say, oh, yeah, there's so much I could say about that. Because, like, anyone knows anything about ADHD, you know, it's so consistently inconsistent. What do you do whenever that strength mm-hmm. isn't showing up? Mm-hmm. like, mm-hmm. is that a superpower still? Like, yeah, I can go on about that. But it's okay.
I've been like sitting with something in my own head that I wasn't sure if I was going to bring it into the podcast, but I think this conversation feels like the right time. I saw a post or a comment on a post maybe 6 months ago, and it grabbed me. And it was something about like when the kind of neurodiversity movement, like when has it entered into toxic positivity? Mm-hmm. And I sat with that of like, because something I talk about a lot here is the importance of holding the both and the liberation and the grief that comes with the later in life diagnosis and discovery.
Yeah, sure.
It's not just in the neurodiversity affirming movement. I think the superpower narrative comes actually, a lot of it comes outside of that movement. But just thinking through like what can look like a strength-based view on ADHD or autism can actually be quite harmful if it's not done with a lot of nuance and complexity, if it's excusing difference, right? Of like, well, you're different, but you're acceptable because, right? All of these superpowers. Yeah. Or if it's, if the narratives around it dismiss a person's experience of what's hard about moving through the world as a neurodivergent human, like, and I think this is, again, this is why I wanted to have you on, is you dive into the complexity. These aren't, rigid narratives don't hold up well here. They can do more harm than help.
Yeah. Like I think that for me, I love hearing people's stories. I love learning about people's stories. So like when I'm working with people, because I do a lot of one-to-one work, particularly with a lot of Black and Brown peoples, but when I'm doing work with them, like the one thing that I, hear through their stories is like obviously how complex they are and how they see what they've gone through. And through that, I just feel like, I don't know, people, we can get so trapped in very narrow storylines of ourselves. Mm-hmm. And I think it can go to the extreme, like either way, and it can have an impact. And we don't often bring in like the other things in our environment or the world around us that have had an influence on how we behave or how we've had to, resist treatment or the things that we've had to do to survive. And that's for everyone. The thing is like, for me, it's like, nobody's free if we're like not able to be who we are in our complexity. Like if we're still having to make up stories that we're not even like in, or that we don't see ourselves in, or if we're only seeing stories that don't include us, if we're only, not allowed to speak about like, here are the difficult, like all of that, then like, we're not going to ever, we're not going to have liberation. We're not going to be able to, create a world that maybe our kids can, it's okay. Like they don't have to have a label. They could just be, like it's Otis and, here are the things that he needs to, be at his best and he knows that. And here are some of the things that he might have struggles with. Like that's just humanness. That's humanness. We all have that, but I think there's a lot of like, obviously, it's like productivity and capitalism plays a lot in that. Like, how can you produce for, the culture, like for my certain culture, which is, big on like quality, quantity over quality and all of this stuff and being productive and linear time, like a lot of this constructs, I don't know if that answered your question, but I just kind of went off on one there.
I mean, it's called Divergent Conversations for a reason. We diverge all over the place.
Oh, well, I take what resonates, everybody, and just leave the rest. It's okay. I won't mind. Yeah. I could say a lot though about the book, but I don't know, like, what what else I could, I'm sure there's lots I could say. I haven't talked about the body yet, but now that brings into it. But yeah, I think there's one thing about this actually I can add to it is like, there's something about like when we're kids, right? And we're in school and we're trying to find a way to fit in and we're trying to like, do what the teacher says and things like that. And I think that, we do end up changing a lot of who we are, stuffing down or trying to find ways to cope in order to become who, we're expected to be as the student. And I think about like even my own experience of how I had to grow up and just like how like you said, like the problem, if the problem is inside of us, then literally like then the solution becomes one that we have to create for ourselves. Like, and as a kid, that becomes like, blamed, shamed, guilted, and trying to, and so that they can change, try harder. You're being lazy and no idea of how to do that. Because we don't know what try harder means. Do you know what it means? Like, I still haven't been able to figure it out. Like, especially when I show up every day, I'm doing the best I can. Like, whatever that looks like, that's the best I could do for today. Like, that's it. But to try harder, we don't know. And I think that there's a lot of, and it ends up being a lot of disconnection. And I don't think it's a surprise that like ADHD overlaps with trauma. Mm-hmm. The be able to disconnect, to have to disconnect from yourself. Because yes. In order to fit in or to do what you're told, you've got to self-betray. Mm-hmm. Like you have got to, ignore what's coming up in your body, the sensations that are coming up in your body, the language of your own body. You've got to ignore it. You've got to deny it. You've got to make it mean another thing so that you can do what you have to do to survive, so on and so forth. And I'm done.
Yeah. I love that you went there. I talk about that a lot, especially with masking, which I mean, we know masking is a survival instinct. It's not some conscious choice, but it's part of the harm. I mean, there's so much harm that happens to talk about fragmentation, right? There's a lot of fragmentation that happens when we mask. But one thing I talk a lot about is how we learn not to trust our bodies because we learn to betray our bodies at such a young age. And that makes us incredibly vulnerable because we've learned to override our instincts, our self-trust. And so a lot of the healing from that fragmentation is, oh my goodness, how do I learn a process of self-trust again? How do I learn to trust my body to stop overriding the instincts? This imagery of integration and disintegration and fragmentation, I'm really liking this, the imagery that you're playing with as you consider the people in front of you and even in your writing, because that feels so key.
Thank you. When I finished writing the book, actually, I realized when I was doing the final edits, I realized, oh my God, like this is about going from disconnection to connection. Mm-hmm. Like this book is about connection. And because for the, like playing what you said, like, and I said this earlier, like a dysregulated body is one that feels unsafe. And dysregulated, and I mean by that is like, if you're not ready, like, calm or content and just at ease, you're not regulated. So you're not feeling safe for whatever reason that is. Even like zoning out or like daydreaming, like that is a way to like regulate like what my body feels is unsafe, what I'm like, and a key point here is that a dysregulated body does not learn effectively, like period.
Yeah.
Go, And so
no system's regulated when the sensory system and the nervous system is dysregulated, none of the higher level systems are regulated. Like nothing helpful is going to be happening there. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. You know, my kid, when it was during COVID and they were having him try to do video and he was not doing video, like he was like really unhappy. He could not do it. But, you know, so he didn't do really much any school, to be fair, during that time. But it was like 2 weeks left before school was they were going to go back. And the 3 months that he was off, like I taught him everything he needed to learn in like 3 hours a day for like 2 weeks, you know. And I'm bringing that point up to be like, it isn't about like it in schools, like we can spend the time that we need to spend on making sure that kids feel good being in those classrooms. The classroom culture, the way that the teacher can feel regulated, the support that the teacher has, the community that they have around them as well, like all of these things play a part in like making sure that the culture that you create is one that has belonging, not just fitting in, not just like, oh, hey, everybody's different and that's okay. But actual belonging where the child feels like, yes, like I can be here as I am. And the more that I can do that, and the more regularly that I feel like as a teacher, the more then I can help create that culture. Without that. So I just, there's so much disconnection. And I feel like we miss the body in a lot of neurodivergent like conversations. And it's doing us so much disservice because there is so much that like I've been able to do with people once we get comfortable inside our bodies. Because the thing is too, is that like people are so, you think that you would go in and be like, okay, we're going to talk about like, we're going to do some somatic work. And it's like, we cannot do it right away because people do not want to be inside their bodies. They've learned that their body
is unsafe. Yeah. I was so dissociated from my body by the time I was diagnosed. And I would joke with my therapist of like, don't you dare ask like where in my body is that located? Cause like that was such an intrusive question. And so it like became a working joke. So if he ever asked it, it was legit just a joke because he knew how much I hated that question. It's really unsafe to tap into a dysregulated body.
Yeah. And think about the stories that we learn to tell ourselves in order to fake it or in order to mask or in order to kind of fit in. Essentially, when I'm starting to work with people, like we just kind of get to know each other in this space. Like I spend a lot of time validating their existence and helping them see other threads, other stories that are more empowering in their narrative, you know, so that they start to trust me and trust, you know, our space. And then whenever we start to do any kind of somatic work, it's very, very like, you know, because neurodivergence, like a lot of us need like to know exactly what's going to happen and exactly what we're going to do and exactly how it's going to be, which maybe a lot of somatic practitioners wouldn't know that. And also like, not everybody can describe or feel like what's happening in their body. So it's very, very short. Our first session, we're looking for safety, like what safety can feel like, which is like pockets of like, oh, that actually feels comfortable. I could hang out there if I had to, like in that sensation, you know? But we learn that discomfort in our bodies means that we are bad. Like, that's the thing. It's like, oh, I feel uncomfortable about something. I have discomfort. I must be bad. I must have did something bad. I'm bad. And nobody wants to be hanging out, tracking feelings of like, oh, I'm really bad. Oh, this means I must be really, you know, no way. So then we've got to learn to like trust that some of the stories that they were told were different than how they actually interpreted it. So we have to pull some of those stories out so they can go, oh, okay, yeah, you know what? I felt that before too. Like this thing that happened and I was actually trying to, you know, they said that I was being aggressive. But really what I was doing, I wasn't going to do any more of that schoolwork because I'd already done it before. And they kept saying that, like, can you tell me another time where that happened? And like, it was, and you were misunderstood like that? You felt that way? Oh, yeah. And then they might tell another time and another time. Mm-hmm. And it's like all of a sudden they've got this whole story and they can feel it in their bodies then. Of like, wait a minute, this is true. Like I had tried to stand up for myself in the past. And then I was told that I was like being aggressive or rude, but actually they didn't see it like that. But this is actually how it's happened. It's happened before. And then we're like, oh, then we can get somewhere. You know, then we can kind of dip in. But it's still very like slow process. And it usually starts with finding, it always starts with finding safety. Like I would never have anybody like go, oh, you're feeling anxious. Let's just track that for a minute. Like, I'm like, what doesn't feel like that right now?
Yeah.
You know?
So locate a part in yourself that doesn't feel anxious and anchor in that to kind of,
Yeah, for sure. And very short. And another thing that I recognized too is realized was that introspection issues, you know, I don't know what the heck we're feeling like half the time. Half of the thing is like reassuring people. No, we don't have to have a word for it. Like we don't have to, you don't have to label it anxiety. Cause like, what is anxiety? Like it could be anxiety riddled with shame, guilt, anger, frustration, like, and it all feels just a little tiny bit different, right? So you don't have to label that. You can just tell me where it is in your body, you know? And some people, they can't, they like, I've worked with people where like, they just can't find the words. So we were like, okay, well, like, well, let's make a scale. How about you show me your, you know, what we'll sit in a place, put the camera where I can see you. And all you have to do is just point to the part. And then on the scale that we made, one meaning, you know, nothing. Five meaning, whoa, this is like big. Just tell me a number. You know, and let's go from there. Instead of trying to go, oh, I can't think of the, oh, I don't know the part, or I don't know where it is, or I can't describe it. Or and then all of a sudden you get anxiety because you can't find the right word of what you're trying to describe. You know, I've had people who were like, I can't, I can only see it in colors. Like, that's fine. Because you know what the color means. We got to have help people learn the language of their bodies with the sensations and have them learn that they are the people that know that language best. So I have people go, oh, it's like that. Does that sound okay? Does that sound all right? It's like, hey, nobody's going to be like, last time you said it was, you know, orange when it was there and now you're saying it's blue. Was that right or wrong? You know, like sort of thing. Like, I'm not your expert on your body. You are. And then it's pretty natural, very natural, that you're not going to know how it could be right away or even have a word for it at all. And it's okay if it's just uncomfortable. I don't want to be sitting there anymore. I don't want to be feeling this right now, you know? And it's okay if last time it was this, you know, X and this time it's Y. And I don't know if I got it right last time or not. Some people would tell me like whole scenes of what was happening in their body. Oh, there's this person and talking like this and he's in bed and it's like a person who has a hammer. It's great. You know, can we say hello to that person? Is that all right? Do they want to say hello to it? No. Okay. So do you just want to ask it if you could just sit by it and just stay with it over here for a while, you know, like so much stuff gets done and it helps a lot of people. Like it just shifts so much. I can't say enough about somatics, like just however we get it through, so however we figure it out, like we work together to just find a way that works for them.
Well, part of what you do, it sounds like, is you co-create a language with the person for them to be able to talk about their body versus using this prescribed language that we've perhaps been given. You're co-creating it in this one-on-one work you're doing with people, and you're helping them create the language for accessing their body.
Oh, yeah. I never thought of that. It's a, you know, it was, I do like intro like things. So it's like somatic focusing is where I do, which I base it on. And it kind of, it works really well for me because it's all about reconnecting the mind and body. So if you have been someone who's just like, I'm so disconnected from that, well, then it's going to be a small, like, little process of, like, you know, we integrate it into our sessions. So, like, they'll be talking about something and just be like, hey, so can we, how does that feel in your body? Do you have it? You know, that's kind of a huge thing you've just said. Is that feeling like anything in your body? And they're like, oh, actually, oh, I feel it, you know, in my chest, or I feel that. And it's, oh, does it feel comfortable, uncomfortable? Or, gosh, it doesn't feel good. Oh, okay. If it doesn't feel good, or I'm not sure. I'm not sure, chances are you probably don't want to hang out there. So let's find somewhere else that might be in your body that you'd be like, yeah, I could hang out here for a moment. So we do kind of co-create a language. One of the things that I do is, like, you know, in focusing, we do repeat some of the things that they come up with and say, or what they've, like, discovered. They can hear it back to themselves and kind of be like, oh, yeah, it's like that. Or, oh, no, it's not like that. It's very, very. I even tell them, I'm your companion. I'm just there. You're not doing this alone. Like, I'm just there. You're the lead. You tell me how long. I'll time it. You know, would you like this lead in? You have 30 seconds left. Do you want to continue for another 30 seconds, or would you like to stop here? So I think it's very empowering. And then we talk about, like, what came up for them, like what they're, you know, trying to make sense of it. It's very empowering, and it can be difficult for people because, you know, one of the things, you know, is like over-explaining, you know, and it's just like trying to, you know, make sense of it. And I'm like, with people I know really well that I work with for a while, that I know really well, it can be like, and okay, I'm doing that again. but it's also in a loving, you know, way.
Because
some people, you can't, like, for some people I work with and I know, it's like, stop there. We're done. Like, okay, let's bring it out to something else now. Because for me, then I know that they're done. Like, they're starting to be dysregulated as well, you know? So that's also a sign, like, you know, I've zoned out, or it's become too much for my body. If I've been able to, like, if I'm trying to over-explain things, if I'm trying to create a conversation with you, does that make sense? That's usually my cue of, like, okay, I'm going to come back to the room for a minute. Let's just chat about something else.
So Patrick actually calls me out on this podcast, because when I get really, I've said in this podcast before, when I get really analytical, sometimes that's a sign I'm kind of low grade, dissociated, out of my body. And so Patrick will at times call me out on the podcast of, like, where are you at, Megan Angela? Because that was a pretty, like, heady thing you just said. So yes, that totally tracks.
Yeah. I do love doing that work. And then just being able to, like, because a lot of people I've worked with have been like somatic, like, oh my God, like, because they legit think that they're going to be sitting, like, for an hour, but with their eyes closed and, like, having to describe stuff that they don't, like, know and not been there. And it's like, no, 1 minute. We might make it to 1 minute the first time. So it's kind of like that. It's fun. Like, you get to see, like, yeah, it's so many stories, so many. That's the thing about narratives. That's what I love. Like, I love narrative therapy. I love the idea that there are so many threads to our stories, that we often get stuck on one that's, you know, very disempowering, very disconnected from who we are. Mm-hmm. And I love the idea of being able to, help people connect through what I discover, you know, through some of my own stories or some of my own thoughts. Like, some of the stuff I think of, it's just like, hey, this is what I'm discovering. What do y'all think about this sort of thing?
I love that you said, you know, just the way that you approach this from different perspectives of, like, what language do you want to use, or what images do you want to use, instead of this black and white, thinking about this is how we talk about what's happening for us. Because for me, I'm one of those people when I can't find access to the words to describe how I'm experiencing something, I shut down. I get really shameful. Like with my own therapist, if she's the person who's like, so where is that showing up for you? And I'm like immediately shut down. But if we use different types of language, if we use parts work, if we use imagery, then all of a sudden it becomes much more accessible, opposed to saying like, I just cannot figure out the language to put into place right now. And that feels really frustrating. So I really like that approach a lot.
Thank you. And I appreciate that. One of the things I love about narrative therapy and even somatic work that I do is that like, I do trust the people that come to me to be the experts in their lives. Like even as young as like my own kid, 9, like I trust that he is that expert. Like, yeah, okay, it's a kid, so he does need some like, support, guidance and stuff like that. But put words in his mouth, like, no. And it's the same with the other people that I work with as well. It's like, it helps, because I don't have to be the one to be the savior, to be the solution. What are they going to do when I'm not there? How are they going to ever, believe that they are capable if they think that the only reason that they've been able to do this is because of, working with me? I want them to see that, this has been a teamwork, and I couldn't have done it without what they know. And I think that's why it's been so important to look at intersectionality and to look at the complexities of, to use that tool and to actually confront my own stories about what I've learned about whiteness, what I've learned about Asian, what I've learned about gender, and where that's showing up in my own work, because I'm human too. I make mistakes and I've had to go through my own, processes of like accountability. And I have a community of people that help me be accountable and not online. And they're, it's not an online thing. This is, I know more about community and being held accountable because of the people that I want, the advocates I'm closest with, that's where I learned to try to do better. And try to see people in their wholeness because they see me in mine, the community that I have. Mm. We all need that.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Patrick.
No, I was just saying that's well said. It's important to have that community in place to create accountability and to have people who can support you in a empathetic, caring, compassionate way when you sometimes falter or make mistakes too.
Yeah. I think it allows us to be human, right?
Yeah. It strikes me how you say like it's not online. And I just think about how important it is to have that embodied connection when we are being held accountable or when there's those hard conversations of accountability in online spaces can have that kind of fragmented feel because you don't have that connection. And so that connection is such a important part of the accountability process.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Like that's everything. You can't. Yeah. I don't know how you can be. No, you can't. I you need people. Like your identity is created in being around others too. How are you going to do better when you have no one around you to help you? Like know what you need to do better. Mm-hmm. When because of the nature of some of the work that we write and some of the things that we do, like if I've had been questioned about things, which, my hyper-focus posts and things like this, some of my stuff has been like questioned, that's for another conversation, but I got other thoughts on that, but for another day. But, and I've had to go to my people and be like, okay, like what do I need to learn here? And what do you think? Like, I have a really good friend of mine that got called out for something and, that she automatically apologized for it. And she brought it to us, like as a part of her community and went, what happened here? And we thought a lot about it and we talked about it, went back and forth about it. And we were like, hey, you apologize quick. And this isn't this wasn't something to apologize like in this way for. So it works both ways too. So it was after that of being like, hey, before you jump out and do like, okay, I've got to do an apology post or what, or I really have to put myself accountable, especially as Black women and femme, we have to bring it to our communities really quick to be like, all right, what's happening here? And where is my accountability? Like, how am I supposed to be accountable here? Or am I? Sort of thing. If that makes sense. Yeah.
The imagery that's coming to my mind is like, if you're moving from a place of belonging, like, so that connection with your community of like being able to kind of workshop those ideas. And if there's an apology to be had, it's coming from a place of belonging versus coming from a fear of disbelonging, right? Like, I am so afraid that I won't belong. And so I'm going to quick apologize before I've thought through like, what is at play here? I feel like the energy of that would be so different if it's coming from a place of belonging versus a fear of disbelonging.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's a really key point is like, I never actually thought about that, but it does make sense because a lot of the accountability is a fear base, you know, and just like, I don't want to be like rejected or actually worse is like kicked out, you know, from the group. And like, you see this too a lot. There's this other side of that too, where it's like, oh, I don't want to be connected with this bad thing that's happened, which is where all the violence I think comes out on like, you know, I'm calling you out sort of thing, you know, sort of thing so that I can be as far away from that as possible. And like that was never the connection of like, that was never about accountability. That was never for accountability. It's about how can I like helping each other be at our best, like do better. It's not about, because what are you going to do with all the people that you call out and decide that they're not allowed back in? Do you know what I mean? Like, what are you going to do with them all? Like it doesn't, it's indigenous, like it doesn't make sense. Like you've got to help them to, better. You've got to, you know, whatever's within your capacity. You might not be the person that has the capacity to deal with that, you know, which is why you have a community, you know?
Well, and it, when you have a culture like that, where there's that fear, like, right, that fear of it, if I'm connected to this idea or this, I'm going to be kicked out. It collapses space for complexity. Yeah. There's something you said. I'm sure I'm going to misquote you, so I'd correct my memory of it. But you did a live with Tiffy and EJ. Okay.
TJ.
Yeah.
TJ. Yeah.
TJ. Okay. And on ABA and intersectionality. And first of all, just that was thank you for doing that. But in that talk, one thing I heard you say was, I think it was something like conversations that don't hold space for complexity are not anti-racist conversations. I might be simplifying, but that there's something about holding space for complexity, like to be truly anti-racist, you've got to have these really have space for complex conversations. Like we will get into the ABA conversation today because that would be a whole other podcast. That's a great example of like, if you're not thinking about this with lots of different threads and thinking, you're going to have a pretty kind of narrow, thin narrative around it that's going to be harmful. So this idea of the culture we build, creating cultures that doesn't collapse space for complexity, I think is so important.
Yeah, absolutely. I you know, I wouldn't get a whole other thing about like the autistic community and culture there, you know, because so many of our most marginalized are like very, very like decentered in a conversation. And, you know, I know a lot of that happens whenever, you know, the most marginalized in a space are not leading advocacy. You know, when you're closer to the center of privilege, you don't see much unless you're always turning around, like continually, always turning around, always looking back and seeing who's behind you. When you were so close to the center, you know, problems like I'm autistic versus I have autism become focus of like a hill ready to be. Meanwhile, if you turn around, you realize what's happening to brown people, what's happening to non-speakers, and all the other complex identities that are within that space that actually need to be. There is a privilege in being able to mask or full or however long that we did before we were diagnosed. We have to realize that. And we also know that there is, like, we hold both. We hold privilege and oppression. Okay? But it's not at the same weights, let's say. It's not at the same. And that's the truth, you know?
It's not the same weights, and it's not that the stakes are different. Like, the safety stakes are different. And I was just recently having this conversation with someone. One thing I'm seeing, and I will own my experience of this as a white person. So there's discomfort with having privilege and having power. And there's a lot of move to try and distance from that. And I, as a white person, when I got my autism diagnosis and my ADHD diagnosis, I will say there was some relief of, I don't have all the privileged identities. And I have my feelings around that but it was a really important moment for me to realize, like, there would be some temptation to try and, like, what's the word I'm looking for? Give myself an out for my white privilege by, like, over-identifying with my neuro-minority. But, like, I can't do that. I can't erase my white privilege because I have one marginalized identities. But I saw the temptation there. And I saw the fact that there was some relief of, I'm not all of the privileged things. And that was hard for me to see, but I also feel like it's important because I'm seeing that. I've seen a lot of people trying to distance from their privileged identities.
Absolutely. And, like, you know, I think there's something about, like, and in doing that, first off, and in doing that, they do nothing with it.
Right.
Besides, like, try to, like, keep hold it a bit. You know what I mean? Like, that also happens. And it's like, well, I have it and I'm using it for my own thing, but I'm not doing it, you know, because I feel so guilty. It's like, well, no, like, you have it to use. Because it's not helping, and it's not helping either of us, though. Because if I'm not getting everything that I need, you know, or if the most marginalized of us isn't getting what they need, then, you know, really none of us are. But when we all do, like, even when they have everything they need, then the possibilities for us, that means we are getting everything we need to. So, like, and it's really, to me, that feels such a simple thing, like, to, like, understand that. Like, I can see the visual of, like, hey, look at, if they had all of these things and you only need this one thing, look at, like, it could be easier. You know, if we were going for, like, all of the things that these most marginalized need, and look at what we could all be living with. So I do, like, and I do understand that there was a comment that I read, and I'm just loving it, you know, and it talks about, like, whiteness, like, whiteness math, and it talks, and it says, like, white plus, and in this case it was queer, equals BIPOC. And that really hit me, because, like, what was kind of what you're saying, that temptation of like, oh gosh, I've got this identity, so I'm, you know, can be most marginalized. Like, remember, the culture is about supremacy. So it's the most, it's the worst, it's the best. So you can't just be marginalized. You've got to be like, oh, it's like the worst for me, you know, because that's what the culture is about, you know? So that totally tracks, that it would be like, oh, okay, I want to be like, I could be more.
Yeah. Well, and I want to distance from the discomfort of acknowledging my privilege and acknowledging how I participate in these systems. And yeah, absolutely. I see that. I see. Yeah.
I'd also say too, like I grew up, like, I was a transracial adoptee. I was adopted by white people. I grew up around white people. I didn't see any Black people. The amount of years it's taken me, and I still have to work through my own anti-Blackness. Like, we all have that in us. Even Black people, you know, like, this has taken so much from, like, to my proximity to whiteness. On the idea that at 40, I could be like, oh, maybe it's ADHD because my little brother was diagnosed when he was 8. And only because my parents were white and were like, the heck's going on with this kid? He's not behaving like other kids that we had that were white from our own. And I knew that because of being my proximity to whiteness. And that's something that I've had to like grapple with.
Yeah. You know,
even like just being Black, I've had to grapple that. And I still grapple with that. And I still do.
Yeah.
So there's so many complex layers of that and so many ways that for all of our stories and how they could be interpreted. And that's why, you know, I'm very big on like, you know, people being these experts of their own lives and people learning to reconnect with their bodies. This is where our truths are. Like 80% of our knowledge is in our bodies. The memories and things of what we know is in our bodies. That's where that truth is. And there's a reason why we learn to keep disconnected from it. There's a reason why that we learn that, oh, that's bad. We're bad. That's wrong. What could we do and accomplish and be when we all reconnected to who we are, who we truly are? Like, what would we be saying? Like, no, this is ridiculous. This is not, I'm not doing that anymore. No, I'm not working 40 hours a week. Like, what would happen when teachers went like, you know what? We're not doing this. What is this nonsense? You know? And when, you know what I mean? And, and how that impacts, like, how we, everything, how we see ourselves, how we decide we need to show up.
Yeah. Patrick, you look like you have a thought, but I can't. Sandra, sometimes with the three-way interviews, there's always the like, trying to decide who has a question to ask. So that's part of the awkwardness you get to experience today. But yes, Patrick, you look like you had a thought there.
I just think it's important to, I'm just thinking about the complexity and the nuance here and just thinking.
Okay.
I think that just thinking about my own identity, it's obviously very apparent when I walk into a room that I am a white man, so for the most part, or male identifying, so married to a Black woman who, so just thinking of all the complexities here that are interwoven and how important it is, like you're saying, Sandra, to talk about the narratives and to connect with the body and to do the work and to do the healing, because I think that that makes a major, major difference going forward too.
And I think for like, you know, when I'm thinking about whiteness and white males, you know, there's so much about like toxic masculinity and whatnot. And a lot of that gets like placed right inside like the guy. Oh, it's so toxic masculinity. And it's like, no, we can't do that. Like, that's not going to work. Because then what ends up happening, we end up having like, you know, substance addictions, you know, in all of the ways that, you know, trying to manage the discomfort without being able to, you know, go to therapy, acknowledge that there's more feelings besides anger, acknowledge that, oh, hey, I had inattentive ADHD, but I was never seen as having ADHD. So I still had to be perfect. And I still had the expectation to, you know, lead society, make all the money, blah, 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 blah. When really I just wanted to be an artist and like hang out in my parents' basement. You know, like, I, do you know what I mean? Like, but I couldn't be that. And then I'm told I'm lazy. You think that the idea of like an ADHD diagnosis, for example, is like, you know, that privilege. But it, in a way, like what I write about this in the book is like, I think it just went, oh, okay, here's a way that we can mold these kids who are not fitting the Eurocentric, you know, school expectation, these boys have, because we made it for them, they're still not fitting it. So let's just give them a diagnosis of ADHD. Not only does it differentiate them from the Black kids that are behaving the same, but now we can like give them something that can maybe mold them better into who they're supposed to be as, you know, male people, like male identifying people. And like, how is that? And like, that looks like a privilege maybe if you're, you know, an attentive ADHDer who is not getting diagnosed and you're a white male, you know, or if you're a white woman or identifying a female presenting person and you're expected to be the emotional hub of your home and the executive functioning head, and you can't do that because you're not supposed to be able to do anything really in school back then. So do you know what I mean? Like, so yeah, maybe it does look like a privilege in that context. If you can better live up to the expectations of white supremacy culture, but really it harms all of us.
Yeah. Yeah. I really like how much you tap back into the collective. We need to collectively return to our humanity and then we could talk about like individual narratives and then kind of more collective narratives, right? We need to heal our collective narratives around what it means to be human. I want to be respectful of your time.
Thank you.
We've taken so you've been very generous with it. And I was like jotting down notes throughout as we were talking, which to me, that's a signal that my mind has been very engaged and I've had lots of imagery flutter through my mind. So first, I just want to thank you for the generative conversation and for talking about your book and talking about the work you do. And the somatic piece particularly, I hear that term used a lot, like somatic therapy, and I really appreciate you unpacking what it actually looks like. Because I think people hear that term and they're like, well, what's that actually mean? Thank you so much for being here. Where can people connect with you, find your book?
I would say the best place, like you can see some of my stuff on IG at nd.narratives, but my Substack, I think, is where I'm going to go to now that the book stuff is done. Thank God. I'm on Facebook, kind of the same name. And now I can actually do another season of my podcast, which I'm really excited about too, because I want to dive in a little bit more into like creativity and just really like just living. Like, what's it like for living as with neurodivergence as our like fullest expression of humanity? Like, how can we like reconnect to that? So I'm really looking forward to kind of exploring those topics a lot more as well. So you can find my podcast, the Neurodivergent Narrative Podcast, anywhere you listen to podcasts too. And you can brush up on my work and writing as I get started to like recreate. I'm so excited to come back into writing again.
I was excited when I saw your Substack newsletter that your book was done, because I think I subscribed right. Like, I got a few of yours, and then I think you went deep into writing book mode. And so then I was like, oh, yay.
Yeah, so it's coming out. And
get more of you back. Yeah.
I'm excited about that. And, and the book, there'll be a pre-order link coming in the next day or two. That's going to be in my bio. Well, by the time this is aired, it'll be in my bios, like, across social media and on my Substack.
Perfect. And we'll include those links in the show notes, as well as a pre-order link to your book.
Ryan, thanks, appreciate it, and I appreciate the conversation. It's so good to be able to chat. It's so good to be able to meet Megan. I'm really excited that we got a chance to meet and chat, and Patrick, is so nice to meet you too.
Thank you
for having me.
Thanks for being here. Really good conversation, and we'll have all of Sandra's information in the show notes so that you have easy access to find that, to order the book, to follow, and to support. So thank you so much for coming on. And new episodes of new episodes of the Divergent Conversations podcast every Friday on all major platforms and YouTube. Like, download, subscribe, and share. And goodbye.